Well, Gavin, again, thank you, man. This is all about you. Our podcast is about your journey in music and really how you got into music. And we'll talk about the new Bush record, which I love. Definitely has the grit of those early albums, which I think is incredible. So
nice.
And I did see that you were, I read that you're born in Marylebone outside of
North Swiss Cottage, London.
Oh, okay.
North London.
Tell me about that a little bit.
Just like 10 minutes from the center of London, really easy. North London. In London, you either North London, East, North, East, South, or West. And okay. North London is a big deal. So this is my neighborhood and small little house, small little life. Weirdly, I was always obsessed with Los Angeles. I don't even know why. I had no concept as to why. I always thought that my dreams would be launched there, and they were. Mm-hmm. And just a regular thing. I grew up with my dad. I mean, I grew up with my mom till I was 12, and then she wasn't there. And then I lived with my dad, grew up with my dad, single father, workaholic. You know, I was like a street kid, mm-hmm. lived on the streets. Like now my kids are so mollycoddled. It's hilarious. Like they can't walk from one room to the other. They can't get their iPad without me helping them. It's a fucking joke. Now it's like, I'd be out in the morning, 8 a.m, come back at 10 at night when I was 12. Easy, just out on the streets, sitting around, playing football, sitting with the guys, smoking Benson and Hedges, terrible hashish, spitting on the thing, really good at soccer, just like a waster kid, and was in love with music. And everyone I grew up with much more into like football and fighting. Uh-huh. And I loved Sex Pistols and David Bowie. So it was my secret, clandestine, closeted music self. Sure. And I grew, there was a record store. This is very Malcolm Gladwell outliers. There was a record store at the top of my street. So wow. every weekend when I'd sort of get, you know, whatever, $5 from my dad or whatever like that, pocket money, I'd go up there and I'd buy a single. And this was the beginning of the middle of punk. So this is when punk was exploding. I could be like 13 and going up and buying all these singles. It was like a perfect storm. And I, you know, I was having my issues. I was living with my single father. Do you know what I mean? It was gritty. Uh-huh. You know, it was gritty. Sure. England, grey and bad food and like cold, but you didn't realize it. You just did it. You lived it.
Right.
And rain and punk music and the establishment and the man and all these things. And I loved all these lovely things in the pot to just make me give me who I've become. And I fell in love with music, and I have no stories of like, you know, oh, my aunt showed me this. My aunt was amazing. She showed me David Bowie. What I mean is there's no music in my house. No,
right.
No one gave me piano lessons. Like I'm trying to make my kids learn the fucking piano, learn something. You can't do anything, learn something. I didn't have any of that sort of like a, you know, thrown up, you know what I mean? More thrown up.
Right.
But that kind of makes you kind of jagged and more interesting and, you know, insecure and weird and aggressive and shy and, you know, all those kind of things that make us who we are, individuals. And so I loved music. And then when I was leaving school, So I played a bit of bass. I had a bass when I was 14. I was in a band at school, but we spent all the time like worrying about our outfits and what the name of the band was.
And
we
didn't do anything. Artwork and everything.
We didn't get that far. Couldn't get the band name. We learned the Jam under the tube station at midnight. Whoa, down the tube station at midnight. Whoa, that's sort of it. And we played one show at lunchtime. And then when I was going to leave school, I just was like, fuck, I can't possibly get a job. That's like the worst idea I ever heard. So I thought I should be a singer. I fucking be a singer. And I loved words because I was in love with books.
Okay.
So books, words, not having to get a job, potentially getting girls and getting money. I was like, listen, I got to do this. I'm like, I was the biggest idiot in the world. I had no reason to ever think that I could break out of this small little house in North London and create this world that I've created. You know, that everyone who's successful creates their own world. And I don't know. It's a mixture of being really stupid and having an instinct for things. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
So stupid I continued. Everyone tried to stop me. I couldn't get arrested for years, you know, like no record deals. I got a record deal quite quick, my first band, Midnight, but they never let me make a record. And I wasn't probably very good. I was learning how to sing. So I only began at 17. So by 19, I was still a terrible singer.
But you got signed at 19?
Yeah, I got signed. Wow. Well, epic. I got signed to Warner Chappell, which took me 10 years and like $150,000 to pay back, to buy back my publishing, those fuckers. But they got me on a £5,000 deal, like a $7,000 deal for all my publishing. I did, it was like walked into a deal from the 50s.
Right. But I mean, how, like at that age, you're just like, oh, a record deal. Like, yeah,
well, I didn't know what it was. It. Yeah. I didn't even know what a publishing deal was. I was so naive. But we got 5,000 quid and fucked me for years. But luckily, I wasn't successful for years, so no one really cared. But when I signed with Bush, mm-hmm. They said, let's do your publishing. And I was like, and they're like, oh shit, you signed for this $5,000 like 10 years ago. We need to figure this out. So they figured it out.
Oh, wow.
And so I had to pay money to get myself back, to buy. Oh, I bought myself back. They made $145,000 on me.
Oh, wow.
I just was a kid.
Yeah.
I was just a kid. I mean, cool business.
Sure.
So anyway, who cares about that? So then I just worked and two other bands. And then when I formed Bush, I let go of all my commercial aspirations. Mm-hmm. Britpop was really happening. I was inspired by Soundgarden, Nirvana, The Pixies, Soul Asylum, Janes. And I just went for it. I was like, fuck it, I'm going to go down in flames, you know? So everyone said I couldn't make music. Yeah, probably right. But, you know, if ever I play this, you know, when I'm doing something else, this was my career. I wanted it to be like some shit hot stuff that people go, how did that, you know, happen? So I did Bush, and that was that. And then, I did Bush for 2 years in England and couldn't get a deal.
I was going to say, because you kind of got picked up with K-Rock, right? Adding the record early on.
Well, what happened is I got a record deal offered. I did a TV show in England called, it was the, oh fuck, what's it called? But it was basically, they had it was a midweek show and they always showed a new band. And
okay.
We basically got on TV, but it was like a demo clash. And we
As
Bush.
Okay.
And we got the video made. And that video, or that 3 minutes on TV became the video calling card that this manager in LA saw. He took us to LA, small label, then Jimmy, then Ted Fields from Interscope and Jimmy Iovine heard the record. Then it went to K-Rock. Then the rest is, you know, then we had the juggernaut of Interscope. Interscope.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So that's how it went. That's how it, you know, kind of went. I mean, after we made the record, I went back to work because we lost the distribution deal in California. We were Hollywood Records. The famous quote was on 16 Stone, not only are there no singles on these records, there's no album track. And the guy threw the CD threw it across the desk. Back in the day when you could behave like Scott Rudin, back in the day when that was the way to do things. Threw the CD at him. So we left there, we got dropped. And that's when Interscope picked us up. And then that was 5 number one singles, 10 million albums.
I was
going
to say, that guy's
good A&R. Great A&R.
Wow. Like,
I mean, not even an album track. That's harsh. Not even an album track.
Yeah, some of the biggest songs of all time are on that record.
Yes, I mean, it's just so show you can't always, you know, don't trust what everyone tells you. You know, it's like I found as being a young musician coming up, you know, it was treacherous. The treacherous ground was to find the balance between listening to people and being open and accepting of the information you're given and being a punk and saying, fuck you. No, I know what I'm doing. Like people said, nah, what about his voice? He don't touch him. There's a guy I know, famously I know, he's actually a very famous, successful restaurateur now in London, Oliver Payton. He's got a lot of big restaurants and he's sort of always on panels and that. He said to my manager at the time, you know, oh, for God's sake, whatever you do, don't let Gavin sing. When this guy started managing me, right? Don't let Gavin sing. I was like, so fucking rude. And when I called him up on it a few years later, I was like, so about your insights into the music world, you know?
Right.
So, but it was so harsh. Oh my God, that's so harsh. Like, you know, so you have to have that balance of being quite, just have enough confidence that you can just deflect and just take that degree of criticisms, mm-hmm. that degree of, you know, problems with you. And I think that if you live a big, loud life where you put yourself on the line all the time and you try and be in a band and you do things that are loud, inevitably, and you add success in, oh my God, some people will really love you and some people will really not love you and some people really hate you. Just if you make yourself big and loud, you're just going to get all the, you know, maybe Prince is the only musician that ever is like has universal acclaim, you know. Do you know what I mean? Like Bono is fantastic. I love him. But people, nothing, you know, love it to tell a story against Bono. You know what I mean? It's all like, you know, do you know what I mean? It's like people just get upset with people that are successful.
Right.
And if someone, and low hanging fruit, no success means that you're sort of untouchable. Like a cool band, you know, recommended by Pitchfork that 4,000 people listen to, no one's going to insult them.
Right,
you know, the
right.
best band of the century, the record of the year, you know, oh great, you know. So they haven't had the audacity to be successful.
Right. It's because once you get at the top, everyone's trying to chop you down.
Yes,
you know,
of course. especially people that know you.
Right. Exactly. He doesn't deserve that.
Nothing's like, worth, you know, everybody knows that no one wants, you know, your friends, you know, your enemies might want you to fail, but not nearly as much of your friends want you to fail.
Right, sure. Well, once you start seeing this, you know, huge success with 16 Stone, I mean, what were those big moments like? I mean, you get the deal and like you're already kind of probably skeptical of a record label, I would assume. Since
I remember going to that meeting with Jimmy Iovine actually and Ted Field and being so confused because we'd signed a deal. And here we were going to another label. I was like, I'm so confused, like more bullshit. I just was really dumb. I didn't quite understand this was a distribution deal. I mean, they could have explained it better, but this was distribution. And when I remember walking into the boardroom and thinking, I can't believe I've come all the way to LA. I thought I was off and running. And now I'm going to this company where they may take us on. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it. I was like, shit, because I've had all this, because in London, I was good enough that I could get demo time from EMI, Clive Black at EMI, Dave Balfe at Food, really close to Dave Balfe. They signed Blur. He was all, you know, there's Sony. Anyone would give me demo time, which was like basically $500, 3 days in a studio, you know, 15 hours a day. And, you know, those recordings, so I could get all of that, but no one took the jump, took the leap of faith. No one, everyone, I guess, saw me face value. No one saw any potential. They didn't see any potential. Because of course it wasn't that good. I was young, but like, you got to allow people to the room to grow a little bit, you know, and have some insight. That's your job, I would have thought. But who knows? I'd love to see those guys now and be like, what's up, gangster?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, how did they say, you say that there's room to grow, but I mean, there sure was. It wasn't right. Like you just had that one record that was amazing, but you have five of the big, you know, these huge songs. Glycerine's like the half, I'm sure that's like on some list in Guitar Center, like do not play the song because every kid's like trying to learn it. You know what I mean? Like,
I would say that I am so grateful and pleased and love my life so much. And every night from when we began in January 95, CBGB's New York.
Was that your first show there?
Yeah, that's the first show on the first tour. First tour, CBGB's.
Okay.
And I'd never played a sold out show before, you know, and that was 16 Zen had just come out. There's no album, just Zen. Uh-huh. And that came in November. And so this was January, and the album was coming out just in February or something. And from that moment, since then, I've experienced such joy and celebration at the shows that even if you get beaten up, you know, in the press or beaten up by other band, whatever you get beaten up by, if every night when you're playing shows, you see X number of people and they kept on growing exponentially, happy, fulfilled, going wild, you go into this sort of state of like, I've just felt, and not in an arrogant sense, in a sense of like I've been swimming an ocean to get to this island. And everyone in these shark infested waters, and everyone has said to me, fuck you, you're not gonna get it. Everyone beat me. When I finally get to the island of success, of a career, whatever level, I was like, I'm here now, I'm gonna nurture this place and don't look back. So that's all I've done is I just concentrate on the island I'm on. And I've now been on this island for 25 years. It's ridiculous and I love it. And I'm still trying to get better, trying to be a better songwriter, better singer, better guitar player, everything. You know what I mean? And I think that's the joy of life, is just to know that you don't know enough. I mean, we just don't know enough. And there's so much to know. It's inspiring. So I spend my whole time between singing and guitar lessons and reading and just trying to just, you know, lead by example. I've got loads of children. I've got so many children.
Well, you have eighth album that just came out. I mean, and all within all those years, it's
that's 10. It was 10 because I got the Solo Record Institute, which should have been Bush Records.
Sure. Okay. So 8 Bush records and a couple solo records there. I mean, you have so much material and so many hits off all those records. It was like
22 hits now.
I mean, it's sick. Yeah. It's like, it's not like you put out 16 Stone.
No one knows that. I only say that because no one ever knows that. When they tell me that, I go, you can't be serious. I go, it is. Look at your stats. I was like, it's okay. It's good. That's good. Hey, look, Ma, I wanted to be a musician. Look what I did. You know,
right. Good. Yeah. Was that a validating moment? Like calling dad? Because your dad was a doctor? Is that what it
Yeah. Was? I mean, my dad only saw one show of mine. My dad's no longer with us. He saw one show in my whole life. And I flew him out to New York and he saw MSG. It was the only show he ever saw of mine. And apparently he just spent the whole time just like staring around because it was back in the, you know, sellout days. And he just spent his whole time just looking around, just couldn't believe it. So just like it was one and done for him. And we had a great relationship. He just was a different kind of dad doing his own thing. But sure. He was not going to come to rock clubs with me and hang out with tattooed girls. That was my job.
Right. But still, I mean, that would have still been a big moment for him anyway. Just
it was
that.
Beautiful. And I, you know, now obviously him not being with us, he died of 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 2.5. It's a beautiful memory. And like, it's such a, you know what I mean? It's not like he didn't come to the Dog and Duck. You know,
right. He came to the huge sellout at least. Right?
Yeah, he came to the huge sellout. He flew in on Concorde. I remember getting him everywhere. I got him limos. That was when limos, now, you know, became SUVs now. But back in the day, in the early 90s, it was limos. And one of my fondest memories of him in New York for that trip was him coming down when he's leaving, which was sad. He's going back to London with his wife. And he goes, you know, we called us to the gym. He goes, Jim, the limo's here, yeah. And I just thought he'd already gotten used to it. Like 4 or 5 days in, that was like, I can't see the ride, son. Where's the ride?
Is the limo here?
Yeah.
I love that. I love
that. So beautiful. It's a beautiful memory for me. Thank you for making me think of it.
Of course, dude, that's so cool. I'm real curious on, you know, after having 16 Stone out and trying to showing them, hey, you know, I've got these songs. I've got the talent. I know I should be here. Was it difficult to, you know, present Razorblade Suitcase? I mean, which also has a million hits on it too. Like, was it hard to follow up something that you already had a major success on?
It was a very brave move. It was not, I wouldn't say it was the most commercial move because Steve doesn't make commercial records. See, they have an abrasion to them of bands I love. Up, you know, the bands he's recorded, I'm obsessed with. So it's a weird one. I think it was just a really brave move. We wanted to capture what the band had become live. And I thought that's what set us apart and what people hadn't realized that, all right, we came out of nowhere. We had 5 number one songs and, you know, whatever, million records, but there was a lot of substance to the band. And when you get successful, it's so dumb. I mean, not ashamed of it now. I just feel bad for myself. When you're young, there's a certain desire to prove yourself to naysayers or to other people, when you should only be concentrating on the people that love you and not the people that are, you know. So it was like it was almost like a fuck you. This is what the band is. And we that's what Steve does, and he captured the band live, and it was very sort of rust colored. It was like this very organic. We've been away 2 years. We were strung out. It was a wild time, and it was a beautiful experience. And then we went after that to do the next record back with Clive, because it was a bit more about making a more studio sounding record. So I don't know. We just went with our instinct, and you know, consistency is everything. And that was a wonderful experience. I do like it a bit more experimentation in the studio, but I don't know. I mean, it was, the pressure was on, but yet there was no pressure. Just enjoy yourselves. And they were only going to put it out when it was right, and then they did. And Swallowed was a massive hit around the world, and Greedy Fly, and so you know, and. I did Bone Driven, which was the ballad, is a cool song, didn't connect as well as Glycerine. That's how it goes, you know. But then I've had loads of other mellow songs. Cables on the next record, that was a big hit. And so
Chemicals.
Yeah,
that was massive song.
Well,
obviously you've had major success. We could talk about every one of your records all day. I know you don't have time for that, but I'm curious to see, you know, where were you at with this new album that came out over, you know, the course of this quarantine? And like, was the record ready prior to like the shutdown? Like, where were you?
Because we had the whole summer. We were going out with Breaking Benjamin. Mm-hmm. We were going to play to some kids on the road. We were going to steal a bunch of fans. We had a whole thing ready. And it was very exciting. Australia was looking good. So no, my manager was the other day lamenting about it. And I was like, oh God, Jesus Christ, we can't, you know, you can't live in a rearview mirror. I mean, millions of people have died from COVID, lost their jobs, lost their homes, got divorced. I was there years ago. So I couldn't, it felt really dumb to navel gaze and be like, oh, what about us? What about me? What about the record? I never thought for one second about it. I just was like, okay, shit, you know, just keep safe, keep the kids safe. Hope everyone's okay. That was the fucking focus. And then when we brought the record out, it had 30 million plays. The songs were really, you know, about the Black Lives Matter with bullet holes, you know, Race Wars, Star Wars, Planet Wars, all that stuff. Look at this, the climate, Earth Day. So that was that. Then we had Flowers on a Grave, which is about the loneliness. Then you had The Kingdom, about the Black Lives Matter marches, George Floyd marches. It felt so of the time. Mm-hmm. I was like, fuck it, this record is right now. I can't believe I made this record. I looked way smarter than I am. It just looked like I'm smart. It just came together. I was like, fuck. So now I'm working on a new record with the guys, and you know, everyone's gung-ho about that, and it's just going to be like the roaring 20s when we go back. You know, everyone's going to have imagine the feeling
when you're
at a show. And are you vaxxed yet? Did you get vaccinated?
I've had my first one. Actually, I'm having my fourth cervical spine surgery tomorrow. So what? Yeah,
wow.
Yeah,
that was a segue.
Yeah, sorry. Anyway, the reason why I haven't got my second one, I was supposed to get it on Monday, but you can't get vaccinated within 2 weeks.
What's happening? Can I ask?
Yeah, of course. So I've got degenerative discs in my throat, basically my whole cervical spine down. So I've got two fusions, like on two of my discs here. Then I have one good disc and then a bad one, but they tried to get it from the backside and it didn't work. Oh, so now they're pulling out the C6, C7 from the front. So anyway, enough about me. I've had a lot. I've got a couple of big old scars, and I won't be a neck model anytime soon. But
What's recovery like?
This is the third time they're coming through the front, and usually the front wasn't that bad. Maybe 4 weeks. The backside was the brutal one. That was about 2 months.
Oh man, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I have The Kingdom to listen to. So
are you married? Do you have a hot girlfriend to come look after you?
I am married. I have a hot wife to come look after me. Me. And I have two kids that unfortunately she's gonna have to wrangle. But I got the first vaccine. I was supposed to get the second one on Monday, but you're not allowed to get it within a 2 week span or something of getting surgery because they're not sure if a complication happens, if it's because of that or whatever. So yeah. I'm getting it 2 weeks from Friday.
Oh, brother, I'm so sorry. But, is there anything we can do? What can we shower you with anything? I mean, Jesus,
it's all you having this conversation with me right now.
You're very philosophical about it. I'm far more worried about it than you are. I'm like, it makes me like parental. I mean, you know what I mean? I feel like brotherly. Like, I feel like my bro. You know.
I feel that makes me feel so good. I really appreciate that guy. Right. I'm like you, but more than you'd ever know.
All right. Well, where are you based? Where what town?
I'm in Nashville now. Actually, I was born and raised in Southern California in San Diego. So my family took the trip here to Nashville a few months ago, like during the COVID thing. And
oh, a lot of people I know have moved out there. Nick Raskolnikov, he lives there. Lizzie and Joe from Hailstorm, they live in Nashville. It's just super cool there, you know. Scott Bruschetta.
Well, we have a room for you, man.
Yeah,
did it. When you come out. Well, Gavin, thank you so much for doing this, man. I really, really appreciate you having this conversation.
For sure. Listen, best of luck, you know, with the next 4 weeks and good recovery.
I appreciate
speedy
that.
Speedy recovery.
Thank you. Before I let you go, can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists.
My advice for aspiring artists is... dive as far inside yourself to mine all the things that make you, to separate you from everyone else, be as interesting as possible, and read lots of books and listen to music all the time and practice. Bring it back.